It's been so long since we've recorded, Tristan.
I know. We both had life happen.
And then also, the first thing on your notes says, praise the sun. And I don't know where you are living right now, but it took so long for us to get set up that the sun has come and gone.
Yep.
For this recording.
I was trying to make a Dark Souls reference, but yeah, praise the sun. The sun is going to play a big role in today's audio wow. Video.
Tristan, we're so bad at this now. What happened?
17 episodes in, and I still can't do basic things. Can't remember what media format we're on.
Tristan, we're so bad at this. I've been editing the first handful of episodes, and I brought real low energy to this podcast at the start, so I'm trying to change that. I'm trying to be more energetic and fun. We'll see which version of Scott that people like more.
You should be like, Scott, we're gonna talk about this today, and you'll be like, all right, let's do it.
You did like a visual joke for the podcast too. Oh no.
I'm good at this medium, which is funny because I actually, like, my first foray into media was like radio, so you know I'm good at this.
It's a return to form for you. Well, what are we talking about today? Praise the sun for what reason, Tristan?
So today we are going into a really fun topic. This is the beginning of a little bit of a pseudo series where we're going to talk about, we're basically graduating to episode 2 of Ancient Aliens. Where we're talking about the theories revolving around aliens visiting us and, like,
yes,
references to this in alien, in, you know, our cultures. And specifically what comes up a lot is human alien hybrids.
Yes.
So we get to talk about aliens getting busy.
That's right. What happens when you cross aliens and humans? What happens then? Did they live among us at some point? I don't know. Why are you asking me? I'm not the smart one. Tristan is.
Speaking of which, my name is Tristan Johnson, and I am the person who sits and reads all the books and then has a thing to talk about every week. And Scott Nice Wonder here is the...
That's me.
Nerd Sync guy who makes this all nice and pretty to listen to.
This is our best intro ever.
Yeah,
I think. Yes.
Usually I'm Scott Nicewander.
I know. Yeah, I'm Scott Nicewander. I know nothing. My extent of research is to watch an episode or two of Ancient Aliens. I believe this topic has popped up in season 12 as well. Because as we've discussed before on this show, Ancient Aliens really just did a lot of the big hitters right out of the gate. And then, you know, they've been going for over a dozen seasons now, and they really got to circle back to a lot of topics.
Yeah.
So this has popped up a couple of times, and that's the extent of the research that I've done. So it's up to Tristan now to convince me that everything I've seen is actually false.
Yeah. So they're up to season 16. So the show has thoroughly run out of ideas and they are returning to old things.
Hey, Grey's Anatomy is season 17, so guess who's winning that one? Well, I may have made that joke before. Now we're cycling through the stuff that we've already talked about.
Shonda Rhimes has infinite imagination, so that's a different thing.
That's true.
So today, we're going back to Egypt, a favorite of the ancient astronaut theorists. But this is a really fun one because this is something that I knew a lot about because my mom's a really big person into Egypt. So my mom went to Egypt for her 40th birthday, and I spent a lot of my childhood learning about Egyptian mythology and all that kind of stuff. So I know about this pretty big figure in Egyptian history and this very big moment in the religious history of Egypt. Mm. So it's like a really big deal, even in normal archaeological terms. But then I did not know that the Ancient Aliens people were making the claim that the pharaoh Akhenaten, who has some very strange looking art made about him, might be an alien hybrid, because what's strange is that the statues of him show a vast departure from the typical Egyptian art style, and his character, his figure looks strangely proportioned, androgynous, and just nothing like the art that you see in other kings. And also, very notably, because they did not get into this in detail for interesting reasons, after Akhenaten's death, a lot of the references to him were all scrubbed and erased from history, because he tried to change all of the polytheistic Egyptians to a single monotheistic faith.
Yeah. I think we've talked about this before.
We did briefly, yes.
Yeah. Yes, this is so. And just to sort of give you a really quick outline of some of the art that Trista has talked about, you can just Google Akhenaten. I said that so wrong.
Akhenaten.
You can Google that person's name. And the most striking thing that you will see is a very bulbous sort of alien-esque skull sort of thing, like big alien round head, kind of elongated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sort of like a angular, like stern looking face and sort of a pot belly. And yeah, a lot of like androgyny and things like that, like not depicted in the typical way of like, you know, big, broad shouldered, muscly men other pharaohs have been. Mm-mm. So this is a pretty big deal. The art is a very legitimate, huge change, and it doesn't get followed up afterwards. And a lot of it doesn't survive because the Egyptians tried very hard to erase it. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, maybe the beginnings of a conspiracy here, but was Akhenaten, the pharaoh of Egypt, an alien hybrid?
I'm convinced. Yes.
Well, the answer might not surprise you.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
But this has given me a wonderful excuse because the story of Akhenaten is probably one of the most interesting stories in Egyptian history. And it doesn't get like a lot of face time for a civilization that everyone's familiar with.
Yeah. Spin this little yarn for me. Tell me about Akhenaten.
Sure. Yeah. So Akhenaten is a huge figure, very important, probably most well known in our culture for being King Tut's father.
Mm, yeah, for sure.
But he had humble beginnings. His original name was Amenhotep IV. And as far as we can tell, his early life was pretty normal as far as pharaohs go, reigning from the brief years the kind years of circa 1353 to 1336 or 1351 to 1334 BC, which for those who want to catch up, that's 3,300 years ago.
Yeah. Why is there that discrepancy there?
It's just about trying to figure it, like
just guessing.
Information from 3,300 years ago is sketchy at best.
Sure. Especially as you've said, from someone who's where their history was almost entirely erased. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like an example, this guy had been dead for over 1,000 years when Jesus was born. So this is
quite
real
old.
Ancient history.
Quite old. Yeah.
But yeah, he seemed to follow typical pharaonic traditions. But then during his early years, it looked like something was changing in his sort of religious worldview. Mm-hmm. He did continue to worship all of the gods, but he did start to build places of worship to a god called the Aten. So he constructed temples, even shrines in cities across the country, and then also made a huge temple complex dedicated to this god Aten at Karnak in the city of Thebes. So this is kind of close to temples to the god Amun, who is one of the more premier deities in the Egyptian pantheon.
Yeah, Thebes, obviously known as the Big Olive in Hercules.
The 1998 film. Yep.
Yep. We all know this.
So there's this sign that he is increasing worship of a specific god named Aten.
Yeah.
Who's depicted as a sort of sun god. Almost depicted as like a disc. But the big thing is that he did a speech at the beginning of his second regnal year, where speaking to the royal court, to the scribes or to people, he said that the other gods that had been at this point worshipped for over 1,000 years, were ineffective, and that their temples had collapsed, and that the only remaining god was Aten, the sun disk, and that he would continue to exist and exist forever. So this, you know, sounds like kind of just typical religious talk, but keep in mind, this is a thousands year old faith. The pharaoh being not just a royal leader, but actually the god's avatar on earth. So like a living deity. And then for this like voice of the gods and ruler of this kingdom that has existed for, like, he's part of the 19th dynasty, not 19th king, but 19th dynasty.
Yeah.
Going and saying all the gods are dead except for the sun god. Praise the sun.
Yeah. Yeah. Praise the sun. There it is. Yeah. That definitely sounds like it would shake a whole lot of stuff up for sure. Mm-hmm.
So he started to grow his sun worship. This is something that had been building. Like, it's not without context. Egypt had a sun god or are several types of sun gods, and sun worship was becoming more of a thing in this time. And even in this period, which is called the New Kingdom, ironically, the pharaoh did also start to become associated with the sun disk. And we do have a religious hymn that is dedicated to the sun that seems to have been popular at this time. So it could be that he was tapping into a popular movement of his period.
Can you go ahead and hum me a few bars of that?
Actually, we can't, because all Egyptian music doesn't have its actual music left. So we can only really guess as to what Egyptian sounded like and what these things actually like, what these actual musical bars were like.
Oh, musical mysteries. That's interesting in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. So there's this period where the sun symbol starts showing up in all sorts of iconography. Mm-hmm. And even in the beginning, there was this period where Aten was like the premier god, but not exclusive. And you see the iconography being associated with other gods, like on Ra Horakhti, the falcon-headed sun god. So this sort of like implementing the Aten over top of the old sun god.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And you see the elevation of the Aten above the other gods. It appears in cartouches around his inscribed name. Cartouche being you probably would recognize a cartouche. It's sort of a way to write down a name to say that it has some sort of royal influence. So putting the name of Aten within a cartouche would implement that he is some sort of ruler of the gods.
Gotcha. That, if anyone is like me and is not familiar with that word, cartouches is spelled exactly like car touches, and that makes me smile for some reason.
And then finally we see this depiction of the Aten as a sun disk with sun rays that come out and end with human hands. And this new epithet starts showing up, which is the great living disc, which is in Jubilee, Lord of Heaven and Earth. All hail the disc. So
all hail the disc.
Going to going from like a brief, like becoming more and more prominent to the point where it takes over as the only god.
All hail the disc, by the way, was also the motto of my ultimate frisbee team in college. So
sweet.
I can relate to this.
So yeah, in the fifth year of his reign, Amenhotep IV took some steps to make the Aten not only the chief god, but the only god. He disbanded the priesthood of the other gods and diverted all of the income to the cults of the Aten. Now, this is not like cult is in the term that we use it today, but in a lot of polytheistic areas and faiths, a cult was usually a reference to a religious group that solely focused their worship on one of the gods. So like in ancient Greece, there might have been Dionysus cults or Hades cults or things like that. So this was the Aten cult was then get it.
Yeah.
They retracted money from all of the priesthoods and then just gave it all to the Aten cults.
Oh, wow. So but you the cult in this term is not like the modern version where we might think like, ooh, that's a little like, you know, like manipulating people and kind of dangerous, kind of scary. This is just like, it's a totally different thing.
Yeah, it's just like, out of all the gods, we decide to be a little club that focuses on worshiping this one specifically.
Yeah, okay.
And the king also officially changed his name from Amenhotep IV to the name we know him now as Akhenaten.
So I get the Aten part of that. Where did the Aten come from?
Oh, that's a really good question. Okay, his name means beneficial to Aten.
Oh, okay. Easy enough.
Yeah, he's... There you go.
Beneficial to Aten.
Yeah. And so, as I said, with the cartouches, they started to depict the Aten as a king in and of himself. And with Aten as the sole deity, Akhenaten started to proclaim himself as the only intermediary between the Aten and his people. Mm. I.e., I am the personal speaker to the Aten, and everyone must worship the Aten by worshiping me.
Oh, I see. Worship Aten by proxy of me.
So maybe there is a little bit of a cult thing going on here.
Maybe there is, actually. Now that we say all of these words out loud.
By year 9, though, Akhenaten declared that Aten was not only the supreme god, but the only worshipful god. And he went and ordered the defacing of all the temples to Amun, there, around Egypt. And
Amun is... You don't mean, sorry, that's A-M-U-N. Not like, you know, a moon, you know, like the moon in the sky.
No, Amun is sort of the Egyptian version of the god of the sky. And eventually, in their iconography, he became fused with Ra, which is the kind of older Egyptian god of the sun. So you often will hear the term Amun Ra.
Amun Ra, yeah, I've heard of that. And of course, I know of Ra because of Yu-Gi-Oh!
Sure. I think that was a little bit after my time. I think it was a bit too old for it when it came out. So the Aten became the universal deity, the creator of all life, who every morning at sunrise brings life to the world. And then when he disappears and the night comes, the world becomes full of darkness and terror.
Oh, yeah, that's scary.
Yeah, so it not only became the god of the sun, but all things, the world, life, whatever you need.
Without the sun, would there be life? I don't know.
No, not at all. But this is interesting because this is a long time ago, and monotheism is not a very common religious practice.
Yeah.
So much so that this doesn't bear out. So don't actually, like, this doesn't turn out to be true. But there are some people who think that this experiment in monotheism might have been the spark that might have pushed, like, the ancient Hebrews to think about doing monotheism, and that, like, this might have been the first, like, stab at monotheism. But this is just speculation. It doesn't bear out in the evidence so far.
Okay.
But yeah, he not only, this is like super duper petty, but not only did he deface all of the Amun temples, but in a lot of places, he also had any place where the inscription said gods, had it scratched out so that it said God.
Like just going in with a little permanent marker and just like a teacher reading over your essay, just like, that one's wrong. Just the one, actually. Just the one guy.
You're less wrong than you'd think. Like, they will literally just go to the places where it's painted and, like, scratch it out.
That's incredible. Is that still around? Like, that's still a thing that you can see that's around?
I think in some way, sometimes they've been painted over. We'll get to it, because after Akhenaten dies, a lot of this stuff gets changed.
Okay, cool.
So there's some debate, though, about how extensive and overwhelming this program was. So for a long time, especially when I was a kid, it was commonly believed that Akhenaten did a complete religious conversion of the whole country and forced everybody, destroyed everything. And it was very, like, you know, very abrupt and harsh.
Yeah, my way of the highway, Buster.
But also, it seems that there was a lot of erasure of God's name, especially to Amun. And also some of his court and many who relied on Akhenaten's patronage did change their names so that it would be a reference to Aten instead of some of the other gods.
Okay.
But there is some reference that at least there was tolerance for belief in other religions. For example, there was at least one courtier who went by the name of Ahmos, which means child of the moon god.
Now this, you do mean the moon. Gotcha. Keeping track at home.
Yeah. And also one of the most famous pieces of art, the workshop where a really famous piece of art from this period, a bust of Nefertiti and other kind of works of portraiture, were found to be associated with an artist who was known as Thutmose, which translates to child of Thoth. And Thoth is the Egyptian god of, like, artisans and creators. So that person's name is also a reference to one of the Egyptian gods.
Makes sense that the artist would have that name.
Mm-hmm. A lot of things also show a lot of the magic, like magical implements, things like amulets and talismans show references to gods like Bes and Tauret. So those are like gods of the home and of childbirth. So you would make these in order to, like, bless a child so that, you know, to try and make them safely get born. Then, you know, there'd be symbols of the Eye of Horus, a very common icon in religious iconography in Egypt. And those were still showing up. And so, like, a lot of this stuff was just showing up in, like, a lot of their magical practices or in their, like, you know, sort of mystical medicine and things like that.
Yeah.
And even in the royal family, there was a discovery of a bunch of jewelry that belonged to the family. And they found at least one ring that does make a reference to Mut, who is the wife of Amun.
Which is, again, not the moon.
Yes.
I'm making this more complicated than it actually is.
Don't worry. Egyptian polytheistic religious practices are also extraordinarily complicated. So it does seem that while Akhenaten did move funding away from the other priests, he did have a lot of tolerance for at least worship or belief in the other gods.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. If you have all these other names popping up that are references to other gods, it implies that at least Akhenaten was, like, kind of chill with it.
Yes. Or it's that he got more hardcore towards the end of his life, and that for a lot of the time, while he only had the worship of Aten as, like, the official state religion, that at least he was tolerant until some stuff near the end of his life where a lot of these, like the scrubbing out of names and stuff might have happened.
Okay. Got a little more petty as time went on.
Yeah. And also the, like, there was power, like, to suck up to the new god that the pharaoh wants everybody to. Had a lot of, you know, personal prestige. And if you're in court and stuff like that, you know, worshiping the pharaoh's new god could obviously get you up in the world. So you did see many people without having to, you know, be forced to, did voluntarily change their iconography. There's a lot of signs that they chiseled out references to Amun on personal items that they owned. And things like scarabs and makeup pots had their names changing. We don't know whether they did this voluntarily or because they were afraid of secretly worshiping Amun still.
Gotcha.
So you can imagine that trying to change a ancient order based on a extremely regular cycle of flooding and this religious order that has powerful priest castes and the symbol of the pharaoh as the living embodiment of the gods. Upending all of that in one 17-year period is going to cause a lot of political chaos. He even started his own city as sort of the center of his work. And it was a city by the name of Akhetaten, just to make things even more complicated.
Sure. Not to keep throwing this back there, but that is also a thing that more modern day cults have also done.
Starting their own cities?
Yeah.
Fair enough. So after 17 years of ruling, Akhenaten eventually died and he was mummified, just like all pharaohs, and buried in a tomb east of Akhetaten. There was a period of a few short reigns of different members of the family, but eventually the next person who would come to really rule was his son, Tutankhaten, who in the second year of his reign started to essentially reverse this entire program.
Hey guys, my dad took this maybe a little bit too far. I'm real sorry about him. Maybe we can just kind of, well, let's rein it back a little bit.
Precisely. So Tutankhaten changed his name to Tutankhamun, who we probably all collectively know as King Tut.
And again, I'm going to imagine the Amun part is a reference to that god,
yep,
who is not the god of the moon,
but the god of the sky.
Yeah.
And after Akhenaten's death, there was a massive backlash against these religious reforms. Akhenaten's sarcophagus was destroyed.
Wow.
And it was just left there. It wasn't removed or anything like that. It was just smashed. Yeah. The city
take
of...
Take that, Dad.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't reign long. He died at 19, so I don't think he was around that long either. But
that teen angst.
Akhetaten, it was essentially the city, was essentially abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
Although some really brave Egyptologists have actually reconstructed his sarcophagus, and you can now see a reconstruction in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo.
Interesting.
Yeah, his mummy was removed after Akhetaten was the city. This is going to get, okay. Akhetaten's the city, Akhenaten's the guy.
Yes.
So let's just get, so once Akhetaten was abandoned, Tutankhamun yes. had Akhenaten's mummy removed and sent to the returned to Thebes.
Big olive.
And then eventually, we think it was buried in KV55, which is a tomb in the Valley of the Kings. Now, I think we've talked about the Valley of the Kings before, but essentially in the very, very old times, the Egyptians had their pharaohs buried in big, elaborate tombs like pyramids and things like that. But then later on, when the issue of grave robbing started to become a real problem, they started burying them in this place called the Valley of the Kings, where they would be sealed away and actually, like, you know, buried and forgotten about. And those places that we've been, there's just been ongoing archaeological work going on in the Valley of the Kings for over 100 years at this point. Mm-hmm. And we've dug up all sorts of things, including King Tut's tomb. The reason why King Tut is such a huge discovery is because he was one of the few pharaohs found where his tomb had not been raided or robbed. So when it was opened up, all of his treasure was still there.
Yeah, we've talked about it, where he wasn't that super remarkable in terms of what he accomplished. But it was just the reason that name is so popular and people know it is simply just because it wasn't robbed. And that's really about it.
But you can also say Tutankhamun doing this sort of like counter-reformation thing here is also, it's kind of a big deal.
I think so.
I just don't know how big his role in it was because he died as a teenager. So
yeah,
we'll see where that goes. But there is a mummy in KV-55 that is male, and and this mummy has been examined many times that they think is Akhenaten's mummy, but they're not 100%. The most recent thing that we found, or the most recent study I found, was a 2010 study done by an Egyptologist by the name of Zahi Hawass, who confirmed, theoretically, that this mummy would be the father of Tutankhamun, which means that this was most likely Akhenaten.
Okay.
But then other people were like, well, things get complicated because... how do I say this diplomatically? The pharaohs had a very interesting tradition of... keeping it in the family, if you will.
Oh, no.
So the thing about Akhenaten being Tutankhamun's father is that he was also kind of his uncle.
Tristan, that's not at all where I thought you were going to go. I thought you were going to say like, oh, you know, people just slept around. So it's possible that it could have been Tutankhamun's father, but... wasn't necessarily the Tutankhamun. Nope. It's just
more that the genetic lineage through DNA specifically is a lot more murky because there's a reason why King Tut tried to have several kids, but none of them ever lived. They were all stillborn, and then he died at 19 of severe illness.
I was going to ask, the whole dying of 19 thing kind of makes a little bit more sense now.
You look at his body. He was a very, very sick man.
That's upsetting on a lot of levels.
Yeah. The genes are a little bit of a mess, but there's like a reasonably good chance that this is the mummy of Akhenaten.
Okay. Now, if they did all this genetic testing, did they find any alien DNA in there?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think they did.
Oh, dang. Oh, well, that puts that to bed.
And the other thing, too, is that there was not only was in the people in power scrubbed, try to, put everything back, but... Akhenaten's tomb was desecrated at one point, and the cult fell out of favor almost overnight. His successors went to long efforts to erase Akhenaten and his family from the historic record. So there's like lots of efforts of... of them literally like scratching the names of Akhenaten from like iconography of him around the country. One pharaoh, the last pharaoh of the 18th dynasty by the name of Horemheb, who was the first pharaoh after Akhenaten, who was not related to Akhenaten's family, started to actually destroy temples to the Aten and use the rocks that made those temples to build new projects, including new temples to Amun.
A little recycling, a little upcycling. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, And that would be a different Amun. I'm going to stop doing that joke. That's getting old now.
Praise the Amun.
Praise
the
Amun.
So, and Pharaoh Seti I actually restored monuments to Amun and had the god's name recarved on a lot of inscriptions where it was removed by Akhenaten.
Rewriting a little bit of that history in a literal sense of just like, and this used to be here and we're going to put it right back.
Mm-hmm. On top of that, Seti I also ordered that Akhenaten and Tutankhamun and a whole bunch of other people associated with the pharaohs of this period would actually be erased from lists of pharaohs throughout Egyptian history.
Oh, gosh.
There was like an extreme effort to just try to pretend that this whole thing never happened.
Yeah, guys, this is a mulligan. We can all agree on that one, right? This one's on us.
Yeah, and then under Seti I's successor, Ramesses, they not only abandoned the city, but then they went back to Akhenaten and started removing the building material to rebuild in other constructions across the place, specifically a lot of constructions in a city called Hermopolis.
I'm loving this upcycling. It's very inspiring.
Like, there's a lot in the past of, like, just destroying history to build new things. Like, a lot of old Roman stuff got torn down in the Middle Ages so that they could build things with it. It's a thing. We didn't respect history until like, maybe 70 years ago.
That's the thing, right? I'm conflicted about it because on one hand, like, boy, I wish that, for historical purposes, it would be nice to like study the original things where they were. But like as like a narrative thing, as like someone who loves a good juicy story, the idea of tearing it down and rebuilding something different or better somewhere else as like a F you to the other thing that the materials came from is like real juicy. And I do like it.
Yeah. So like this feels like it's very bloodless because we're talking about this, but this is like, you can imagine that like tearing down the temples to the main god, building temples to a new god, and then a generation later tearing down those temples to the new god. But like, that's all associated with a whole lot of political upset, yeah, and a whole lot of like religious turmoil and such like that for a society that is known for being remarkably stable. Like,
yes.
Egypt, if there's one thing about why Egypt persisted for so long, is just that heavily defensible, extremely stable climate. And everything about their society was just like this endless, like multi-millennium long system that did not break from time, like did not break from a time when mammoths still existed all the way up until Cleopatra the Ninth, when Egypt fell to the Roman Empire. So like to an amount of time that Cleopatra the Ninth, the last pharaoh of Egypt, lived closer to our period right now than to the beginning of the Egyptian kingdoms.
That's, it's so wild to think about.
Yeah.
I love when we talk about Egypt. It's really interesting.
It's like, it's just absolutely mind-blowing how old everything is when you talk about Egypt. So the last reference we also have to Akhenaten in this sort of post-Reformation period is there's one scribe who refers to the period of Akhenaten's reign as the time of the enemy Akhetaten. So the only reference to him in the history, the official history, is as an enemy.
The enemy. Ruthless. Absolutely ruthless.
So the period of this religious uprising is typically known as the Amarna period.
Okay.
And what we see here, though, is that Akhenaten's big upset actually made a long-term shift in the power of the pharaoh within the religious life of Egypt. So if you think about it, for a long time, the pharaoh was God on earth, was a like literally voice of the God on earth or the gods on earth. And when this whole religious uprising happened, or when this whole religious churning up happened, it led a lot of people to no longer see this title of pharaoh as like this actual god king title. And so the relationship that like regular Egyptians had with their gods and the pharaoh changed, and the role of the pharaoh started to become smaller, and that people in Egypt started to see their relationship with the gods as more direct. So before the Amarna period, the pharaoh is the literal son of Ra and the living incarnation of the god Horus, and maintained divine order through rituals and offerings and stuff like that. But this led to a close relationship between people and the gods, especially the patron deity of their respective towns and cities. What this also resulted in is the priesthood becoming a more powerful class of people. And instead of worship being through the pharaoh and them being like this representative, different parts of the clergy would become more prominent. So because they had a period where the pharaoh rejected all of the important festivals and all the rites and rituals that they thought kept the world going, basically. So by, you know, a few centuries after Akhenaten's death, the relationship between the people, the pharaoh, and the gods didn't revert. Worship of all the gods returned, but the relationship between the gods and the worshipers became direct and circumvented the pharaoh.
We don't need that middleman.
Yeah, and the Egyptians started to believe that the gods directly intervened in their lives. Sort of like, I guess a good example would be probably if you think about the way that Protestants changed Christianity, that, you know, in the past, in the Catholic-only days, you only prayed through intermediaries, saints, priests, those kinds of things. And then Protestants were like, no, we're going to do the personal, like Protestants are all big on the personal relationship with the divine, right?
Yeah. I'm going to speak directly to your manager, please.
Yeah. And the increase in the prestige of the priests of Amun became so big that by the end of the 21st dynasty, there were priests who were effective rulers over parts of the country.
Oh, wow.
So like a great decentralizing of the authority and power within this kingdom.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The other thing that's really interesting is that it also, and this is another like interesting parallel with the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah, okay. Hit me with it.
The Amarna period accelerated the change in language between what's called ancient Egyptian and what's later called late Egyptian. So like during the Amarna period, religious texts and inscriptions started to regularly include kind of vernacular linguistic elements, which means that they were like taking words and phrases that were from the spoken Egyptian of the time rather than this like religious priestly language that they typically did religious things in.
Okay.
And over time, in pharaohs following Akhenaten, this became more of a regular thing. So while the successors tried to erase his art, his religion, and even some changes to language, some of these elements did continue throughout the periods later. And that means that effectively, you can see a change in the grammar of the Egyptian language.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. So then we can get to why in all of this, we can then start to get into why these statues of Akhenaten look so weird compared to other Egyptian things that makes them think they're aliens.
That's my biggest question. So, I mean, you were just talking about how even just like the grammar of everything changed. There were obviously lots of the sort of power was changing. All this seems like it might impact a lot of things, including potentially art.
Yes. So Akhenaten actually might have spent some time working with crafters and artisans in his youth, which might have inspired a big focus on changing the art style of Egyptian royal portraiture.
Okay.
So in the times before Akhenaten, depictions of the pharaoh would be very highly stylized and actually very similar. So sometimes if, say, they needed to change the name of a pharaoh on a statue, say if one died and they had to replace it with another one, sometimes they would actually just slightly change the face and then change the name and just go with it, because every pharaoh is kind of just made to look the same.
I mean, they had a lot of similar DNA as well as what we were saying. So I think that may have also helped.
And that also includes the male and female pharaohs, I will add.
That's really funny. Just like, hey, can I copy your own work? Yeah, but don't make it too obvious.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, there's some interesting ones of times when Egypt was ruled by a queen where the statues are like very obviously of a man's body, but they just put a woman's head on it.
No one will ask any questions. It's fine. Mm-hmm. We wrote the name under it if anyone has any questions.
Yeah, but Akhenaten's statues don't look like this. They're a severe deviation. And he almost has, as we said, this like feminine body with wide hips and even breasts, and having this drooping belly, long spindly arms, and this protruding chin. And there's been a lot of times that people think that this might be a move away from this heavy stylization to a more realistic look. And they're like, but this is maybe what Akhenaten really looked like. And so if that's true, then Akhenaten was a very strange looking dude.
Yes, very, very, very much so.
So some of the main theories is that he might have had something called Marfan syndrome, which is a disease that affects a lot of physical traits in men. It's a genetic disease that affects their connective tissue. And people with Marfan syndrome tend to be really tall and thin with really long arms, legs, and toes.
Sure.
And depending upon like Marfan syndrome, you know, people have it today. It can be very mild to very severe. You can even have, you can even die from it if it affects your heart in a certain way.
Mm.
But the other idea, and this is one that's coming more into vogue these days, most Egyptologists think that it's probably not that he had Marfan syndrome, but that this is not a realistic depiction of him, and this is a different type of stylization.
Gotcha. So originally, the depictions of pharaohs were stylized, and then one idea was, well, maybe this is realistic, but this idea is saying, well, actually, it's just a different way. It's like two different comic book artists where they'll have different styles, but neither one is quite as realistic. There you go. I brought comic books into everybody.
Good stuff.
Yay.
Yeah. So like the idea is that maybe this wasn't a realistic depiction of Akhenaten, but instead it was more of a way to interpret who he was through the lens of this new monotheistic religion. So they made him look more androgynous in order to reflect the fact that the Aten was an androgynous god and sort of reflect that. And the reason they believe this is because one thing that the pharaoh did that a lot of other pharaohs before him did not do is show a lot of sculpture or make a lot of sculpture of his wife and his family. And so they did a very similar thing to his family members. Women in ancient Egyptian art, just like the men, being hyper masculine, were all depicted as youthful and slim. But he has statues of women in his family who have wrinkled faces and, you know, the attributes of women who've given birth to multiple children.
Interesting.
Queens and children typically had a subordinate role in Egyptian art and did not feature very frequently. But that was not like Akhenaten. His wife Nefertiti and their children showed up often in art that was associated with Akhenaten, and their size relative to him was pretty equal, like the usually based on how tall they were and things like that. And so it's interesting that his family played a larger role. And so it's like this, it's thinking that,
yeah,
he had a much more egalitarian look, or I guess that's kind of imposing modern values on it, but he had a larger role for family and women and femininity within however his religious outview looked.
Get the whole family in here.
Precisely.
Yeah, show them all off.
So this is likely what happened. It was a big change in the artistic movements. Again, it was possible that Akhenaten spent a lot of time working with priests of Ptah, the god of craftsmen, and probably had a lot of opinions about art. And so that's why the art changed a whole lot. And after Akhenaten died, there was a big backlash against his religious movement, and that reflected in the language and in the art. And so there was an active rejection of this new approach to creating like sculptures of his family and or even paintings of his family. And so there's a lot of questions. This happened 3,000 years ago. There's a lot of really interesting stuff going on, but none of the things I mentioned today are big gaping mysteries that only an alien could fit into.
Well, and that's the thing, right? We're talking a lot about this history, but you haven't even gotten to the main question, Tristan. Where do the aliens fit in? Okay. You've been talking a lot about this history. I've been learning a lot. It's been really fascinating. But we're here to talk about aliens, and you haven't even mentioned aliens barely at all. And the show I watched earlier today said that Akhenaten was absolutely, definitely an alien. So refute that, sir.
Well, what I'm putting out here is that a lot of the points that are brought up to explain why Akhenaten was an alien or an alien hybrid can be very easily explained through other things in the context, like how, why did this person show up and all of a sudden change the religion? Well, you can see that there was a growing sun worship even before Akhenaten's reign, and that he just probably capitalized on that. Why is the art depicting him so weird? Well, he obviously was very artistically inclined, and there was a major change in religious viewpoint, which led to a lot of artistic changes. Why was every reference to him scrubbed from the face of the earth? Well, Akhenaten obviously became a very big liability for the authority of the pharaohs. And so they actively worked to erase him from history because it's seen as this dark period of their past. And all of a sudden, you have explanations for a lot of the broad strokes as to why this period of Egyptian history is so weird that doesn't require making the leap of faith that aliens somehow traveled multiple light years in order to screw around with one country in Africa.
That's fair. And maybe just to ask one final question. Now, we have a possible mummy for Akhenaten, whose DNA that you said people looked at, pretty human, but could be something, you never know, again, because the DNA is all wonky. It's just a possible, but we do definitely have Tutankhamun, right?
Yes.
His son.
And his son seems to be very human from all
Dang
the DNA
it, that
they
was
did.
My last, ah, oh, that was my last hurrah. I was, all right, that's fine. All right, I'll accept that.
And the other thing to add on to this, and I feel like I'm just going to have to need to bring this up every time, but whenever they talk about human alien hybrids, it just blows my mind because like there is no aspect of ancient aliens that seems less scientific than this part. Humans, yeah. Like I'm no astrobiologist, but we can't even interbreed with our closest relatives on Earth. Like we can't interbreed with like chimpanzees and bonobos.
Thank you for throwing thank God into that. Yeah, I agree.
if we can't even have children with like our closest relatives that are only a few million years of evolution separated from us. Mm-hmm. Why would somebody think that it would be even in the realm of possibility that a species that has evolved in a completely different astrobiology, people are suspecting there's going to be all sorts of stuff. People could suspect that there might be creatures where like arsenic is part of their biological chemistry or whatever, like whatever biological chemistry evolves on those planets. Like it's not going to be anything close to even what we would define as life on Earth. Like even categories like animal and plant are going to be not compatible. And we're going to have to, like, when we discover alien life, we're going to have to completely change the way that we think about and categorize life as a concept, let alone being able to think that we will have a species similar enough that you could just mash two things of DNA, if they even have DNA, together and wind up with a thing that could possibly exist. And for me, like, there's a lot of stretches of the imagination and, you know, really, really trying to reach with the credibility of the science in a lot of these claims. But this hybrid thing really takes the cake in my mind. It has got to be one of the least scientific ways to look at it, and feels very, feels almost like fantasy. Like, this isn't Star Trek.
You said a lot of really important things. You made a lot of good points. But the thing I'm willing to take away from that last big speech of yours is that you said, when we discover alien life, it's out there, folks. It's out there.
Oh, yeah. And I'm still open to that.
Absolutely.
The other thing, too, is that they bring this up in the context of Egypt because of years and years of grave robbing by Europeans. We have this very mystical view of ancient Egypt. It's very romanticized, and we think of it as this very like mystical type place, when it was a society that functioned day to day like any other. It had politics, it had religious strife. It was a society of people who lived, had children, died, farmed things. And when we like these kinds of stories kind of show that underneath all of the pyramids and gold and mummies, that there was humanity in this impossibly long empire.
I think this is one of those episodes of this podcast where hopefully we have shown, by we, I mostly mean you, of course, have shown that the actual real life history as we understand it today is, in my opinion, way more interesting than this idea of aliens. Like, this is like political religious intrigue of this really interesting place with fascinating, almost like larger than life, I don't want to say characters because they were very real, but you know what I mean. Like, this in itself, the story that you've sort of untangled here is really interesting, and I don't think we need to throw aliens in the mix to make it more interesting. I think it's, as it stands right now, I mean, I'm hooked. I've been gripped this whole episode.
And we haven't even gone into, like, you could do some more fun history. You could talk about how there were probably black pharaohs, where they were ruled by dynasties that came from modern day Sudan, and all sorts of fun stuff. So yeah, it gets Egyptian history has got a lot going on.
Absolutely.
Really fascinating stuff. And I'm sure we will be returning to it again and again, because like moths to a flame, ancient astronaut theorists love looking at stuff in Egypt, and
they sure do,
pointing at things that are weird and saying, that's got to be an alien, right?
They love those big triangle buildings so much. They love those buildings.
But we'll have to come back to that another day, because we have, I think I've Egypted us out for one sesh.
I also think that. Thank you so much for enlightening. This has been so much fun. And folks, if you like listening to this, guess what? There are new episodes every single week of this podcast. Please, I was going to say like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe.
Oh my God. We're so bad at this. please follow us on Twitter at It's Probs Not Aliens. That's where you can get more updates about this show. If you want to follow us, each of us individually, you can follow me at my YouTube channel, called NerdSync, NERDSYNC. That's where I make videos about comics and other nerdy things, and it's a good stuff. And Tristan also has a YouTube channel.
I do, theoretically. It's Step Back, where I make stuff about the past and why it's important to remember things.
Not dissimilar from this podcast. And of course, you can always give us those great reviews, those 5-star reviews, specifically 5-star reviews. I don't know what past me might have told you, but we're definitely looking for 5-star reviews for this podcast in the future, because as of this moment, this is the last episode we're recording before we go live, before we finally launch the podcast. In the future, I'd love to read all of your reviews on air. I think that would be a lot of fun. So please send them in. We really appreciate it. And tell your friends, you know, what better way to learn about new podcasts than from the mouth of someone you care about?
Yep. And until next time, everybody. The truth is out there. Probably.